Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why poison control centers are seeing an increase in calls related to marijuana, and the story of Mr. Grand Canyon. But first, President Trump won the White House in large part by winning the handful of swing states nationwide, including Arizona, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And one of the reasons that happened was how independent voters cast their ballots. Across the country, more independents supported former Vice President Kamala Harris. But in Arizona, North Carolina, Georgia, and Pennsylvania, they backed President Trump in larger numbers. And those same independent voters also helped a number of Democratic Senate candidates win their races. These and other findings come from an analysis by ASU Center for an Independent and Sustainable Democracy. Tom Riley is its co-director. He's with me now in studio to talk more about this. Good morning, Tom.
Mark, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So I want to talk about this notion of ticket splitting first off, because we don't see it a lot with voters who are registered with either the Democratic or Republican parties. How significant was it with independents?
It is. You know, based upon the data that we analyzed at 23,000 exit polls, they had independents were much more likely to split their ticket than Republican and Democrats. About 96% of Republicans and Democrats vote straight ticket. Independents, on the other hand, were significantly more likely to split their ticket, particularly on the Senate races.
So what does that tell you about how candidates and campaigns maybe should approach these voters?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the reasons for that is it's not a surprise that independents continue to outpace, you know, people identify as independents outpace the two major parties. The challenge is that their behavior is somewhat hard to predict, and they tend to look at the candidate, the political climate, or the events leading up to the election and making their decision. And that, again, makes this unpredictability is why the campaigns often target this group of voters that are quite elusive, but can defy expectations given their voting patterns.
Well, and as you and I have talked in the past, an independent isn't necessarily just somebody who's straight in the middle, right? There are independents who are very conservative, independents who are very liberal. So I would imagine that makes it even more challenging, A, for the campaigns to find these voters, but also to figure out how to talk to them.
Sure. And, you know, if we look at their behavior, it continues to be very unpredictable. You know, if we look just at some of the national voting of independents, you know, they supported Obama by 8 percentage points and flipped and supported Trump
in 2008.
By 4 in 2016. And then in 2020, supported Biden by 13 percentage points. In this last election, nationally, they trended towards Harris by 3 percentage points. But that's a 10% swing in 4 years. So that's a lot of kind of interesting behavior. And as I said before, is that the data is really showing is that despite a lot of attempts of reaching across the aisle, Republicans vote Republican, Democrats vote Democrat, and they vote straight ticket.
Does that potentially give a state like Arizona, which has a lot of independent voters, maybe more swing, more sway in national elections?
It does. And I think that's what we saw in the particularly in the swing states where, you know, we saw particularly in states like Nevada that 14% of the independents, you know, split their vote between the president and the Senate. And, you know, many partisans are, you know, pretty mystified by this notion that how can somebody, you know, vote for perhaps a president and then ideologically a different position on a ballot initiative or a Senate. And that's what we're seeing, you know, and we're seeing particularly among young people that increasingly are identified as independent. They're looking at more pragmatic solutions versus ideological purity. And I think that is what we got to get our heads around, right, is that in the past, particularly in polarized times, we tend to think that people vote straight ticket. Well, they do if they identify with parties. But this emerging group of voters, particularly young people, seem to be kind of cherry picking, right, is that they're looking at a candidate differently at the national level versus the local level. They're looking at issues that they may feel really strong about, but, you know, categorizing that different than perhaps voting for a national or local candidate.
It's interesting, though, because in some of those cases, I would imagine that voting, like that you're voting for two candidates who have diametrically opposed viewpoints. For example, people who in Arizona who voted for President Trump, who bragged about putting Supreme Court justices on the bench who overturned Roe v. Wade, but then also voting for the abortion initiative. Like those are in direct conflict with each other,
sure,
aren't they?
But, you know, a lot of them, you know, a lot of these voters, these independent voters, too, are looking at them a bit differently. They're looking perhaps as I feel very strongly about the economy and I support this candidate because I feel his or her policies have, you know, are stronger on the economy. But I also feel, you know, very important about abortion rights. But, you know, I'm not necessarily always linking them together. I'm kind of approaching them on an individual basis. And this is different. And I think, you know, campaigns need to, you know, reevaluate, number one, how they're targeting these individuals, how they're getting information and how they're appealing to them, because they are increasingly defying expectations by voting differently.
Well, so let me ask you about that. How do you expect to see candidates and campaigns talk to this group of voters going forward? I mean, the study also found that the number of independents went from 26% in 2020 to 34% in 2024. That's a pretty big increase. So how do you think campaigns are going to evolve their communication with this group of voters?
Well, one is I think that, you know, if we're looking at young people, you know, relying on the political parties as conveyors of information doesn't work, because the majority of young people are not party aligned and they're getting their information from different media sources. So I think, you know, looking at those different type of media sources and appealing, you know, based upon a candidate or an issue very differently. But I think it's also this cognitive, you know, ability to reach out to this group of voters to figure out where they stand on certain issues at the time. You know, there's a lot of talk in this past election, perhaps, of trying to court voters, Republicans and Democrats. Harris made a lot of effort, particularly in Arizona.
Yeah.
With the Mormon vote, she had some high-profile endorsements. But at the end of the day, Republicans voted Republicans, and Democrats voted Democrats. Perhaps those campaigns may have been better off by targeting independents who don't have this kind of pure allegiance or ideological allegiance to one group or another.
That is interesting. Mara, we'll have to leave it there. That is Tom Riley, co-director of ASU's Center for an Independent and Sustainable Democracy. Tom, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Marijuana has been legal in Arizona for quite some time. Voters approved medical use back in 2010 and recreational in 2020. And while we generally consider it safe and not addictive, new reporting from outlets like the New York Times show that's not always the case for everyone. While most people aren't going to experience any problems with cannabis, we're learning more about the negative reactions some people have as time goes on. And our next guest says much of them stem from confusion over dosages and the unregulated but still intoxicating versions of the drugs you can buy outside of dispensaries. Dr. Brian Kuhn is a pharmacist and clinical toxicologist with Banner's Poison and Drug Information Center. He spoke with my co-host Lauren Gilger.
The more you make some product available to the general public, the more likely we're going to start to see increased use, increased cases, and, you know, unfortunately, some increased issues from these types of exposures. And even preceding the legalization in 2020 for recreational cannabis products, we had already started seeing an increase both locally and nationally. We'd seen an increase in the numbers of calls and cases reported to the 55 poison centers across the United States. Our calls seem to have more or less plateaued in the last couple of years. So in 2023, 2024, we saw somewhere in the neighborhood of about 400 to 500 calls coming into our poison center. And probably the most expected trend, if you will, were the increased calls related to children getting into these cannabis products. These are products that don't always give you the clear indication that they are indeed cannabis containing. And so whether it's a child finding a cookie, a brownie, a gummy bear, or what have you, or an adult just unwittingly finding, you know, these products around the house, we started to see this increase in the call volume at our center, even before the legalization of recreational cannabis products in 2020.
Okay. So you mentioned kids and sort of accidental, you know, kids eating an edible kind of thing being one of the top problems that you see. But let me ask you also just about this issue of dosages. Like, are there calls from adults who just do not know how much THC they're ingesting?
Yes. And we have a couple of things that need to be sort of sussed out in this entire process, because mm-hmm. we can get cannabis products from the licensed dispensaries that are part of the Arizona Dispensary Association in the state that have to adhere to prescribed rules that were promulgated in the 2020 Prop 207 passage. These rules indicated what type of packaging labeling requirements had to be in place, what sort of dose limitations and total dosage in a package. And we find that there are, in sort of that camp of cannabis calls, the history or the information tends to be pretty reliable from what the caller is able to give us. But then we have the products that fall outside of what was in the Farm Bill of 2018 and right. Prop 207 in 2020 that allowed for, let's call it, the psychoactive hemp-based products. So this would yeah. include Delta 8, Delta 10 THC products, CBD products. So in that sort of second camp, we have far less reliability with respect to the potency, quality, and purity of the product that we are getting phone calls on. It makes it a little bit more challenging to predict when and to what extent or the severity with which we'll expect to see sort of the kind of anticipated clinical effects.
Yeah, that makes sense. So these intoxicating hemp products are becoming an issue at your level as well. We expect maybe to see some legislation on that, I think, at the Capitol this year, right? Like looking at whether or not these should be regulated here. They're regulated in some states, but you don't know exactly what you're getting.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, ultimately, you know, the Farm Bill was pretty narrowly defining what was able to be sold by dispensaries. And it was very specific that it was going to be this Delta 9 THC product, which tends to be the poster child psychoactive compound you find in the cannabis plant, but is really only one of several hundred different compounds mm-hmm. that you find in the cannabis plant. You have the analogs like Delta 8, Delta 10, and really all that Delta and the number designation means is it's the same compound, just in a slightly altered form. And so we find it doesn't always have a sort of a one-to-one equal potency with the Delta 9. We generally expect like Delta 8 to have about half the potency of Delta 9, but it's still, if you take, you know, an equipotent dose of the Delta 8, it will result in the same sort of clinical effects as Delta 9.
Interesting. Okay. So that's one issue you're seeing. What about when it comes to this dosage question, even for, you know, more regulated cannabis products in the state? Like, is it like somebody who has never used marijuana is getting themselves sick because they don't know what they're taking or they took more than they should? Or is it more like people who use every day can see problems?
So the new user of the product, Let's be honest. I mean, when it comes to the dosage from products you can buy at a dispensary, they are typically limited to having a total of 100 milligrams per package. And the typical dosage unit you're going to find is a 10 milligram gummy, let's mm-hmm. say. So it becomes very imprecise when you bite off a half or a quarter of that gummy to get your 2.5 or 5 milligram dose, if that was your intended dose. And so, you know, this very imprecise dosing and dosing that might be predicated off of someone else's use history or experience might be more or less than what you are willing to tolerate.
I wonder what you think of the regulation we have set up and if there are things you think should be done to help people understand this better as they use it.
I mean, that's a fantastic question. And certainly, you know, there are regulatory issues that could be in place that standardize any cannabis product, whether it's a CBD, CBG, CBN, THC product across right. head shops and dispensaries. There's, you know, but those gears tend to move more slowly than just becoming an informed consumer on our own end. So, you know, having a discussion with your personal physician or even those at the dispensaries. This is their product. They want a consumer who comes back to buy quality product. So, mm-hmm. you know, ask the pertinent questions that exist in your mind to those from whom you're purchasing the product from. But also, you know, poison centers, physicians, medical professionals can all weigh in. You know, we all might come with our biases, but, you know, if you're asking for objective information, hopefully you're going to receive an objective answer to your question.
Okay. We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Brian Kuhn, a pharmacist and clinical toxicologist with the Banner Poison and Drug Information Center, joining us to talk more about this. Dr. Kuhn, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, shedding light on informal treatment centers in Mexico. But first, the mass deportations that President Trump has promised to start carrying out early in his term has some people who are eligible for it to apply for dual American and Mexican citizenship. Susan Barnett has written about this. She's deputy editor at Tucson Spotlight and Foco de Tucson. She joins me. And Susan, how common is it that people are trying to secure their dual citizenship?
Yeah, so there is really no numbers. That's something that the Mexican consulate have. This is all really anecdotal evidence that I've seen, myself being someone in the Mexican-American community and having family members, friends. Also, it all started at the beginning of the year when I posted to my Instagram that getting my dual citizenship was a New Year's resolution. And I had a surprising amount of people that I didn't know that were strangers that I saw in passing online that swiped up and said, hey, this is something that I've wanted to do for years, but it seems like the process is very difficult, very drawn out. And it was, like I said, a surprising amount of people. So I took that as a sign to really delve deep into what the process looks like. And in my conversation with the Mexican consul, Rafael Barcelo Durazo, he told me that now is the perfect time. If anybody was waiting to do it, they should do it now because of the incoming president and the incoming administration. He said, because of the threats to deportations to our immigrant communities, if a family is deciding to move back to Mexico, or if they are forced to move back to Mexico, it is beneficial for the people that are in that family that are maybe American citizens to have their Mexican citizenship because it allows them to work, study, and it brings about so many benefits to people that are moving to Mexico if they need to, if they have to, or if they want to.
Yeah, I'm curious about some of the people maybe that you interacted with on social media. Was this the reason that they said they were looking to do this? Because they're either nervous about perhaps having to leave the country or maybe choosing to leave the country and wanting to be able to work, go to school, et cetera, in Mexico?
So personally, for the people that have reached out, it was mostly something that they have wanted to do for years. The administration really had nothing to do with it. But what the consul told me, it's not something that people are actively doing, but it is something that they should be doing. It is something that he said people should be thinking ahead to these steps, because obviously people that are part of mixed status families are going to be gravely affected by any deportations that might come their way. And there, because there's a lot of anxiety about family separations and deportations, the consul is advising for people to take these proactive steps to ensure that if something were to happen, that they have that safety net in knowing that they can go to Mexico and they can also live a good life there in terms of being able to work, being able to get an education, and being able to live legally in Mexico as well.
Is there a difference in the process to get dual citizenship if you do it in the United States versus if you do it in Mexico?
Yes. From what the consul told me, the process getting it here in the United States is much simpler than it is in Mexico. Here, it is mostly about gathering documents and having two witnesses that can attest. And here in Tucson specifically, the process is mostly online. You gather all the documents that you need, you email them to the consul, and then they reach out to set an appointment with you. The entire process here is completely free. And whereas he said in Mexico, it is a different process that can be a little more jumping through hoops. Now that you are in Mexico as an American citizen, it's a like I said, it's a different process.
Right. So we've been talking about individuals, you know, preparing for the incoming administration to some extent and what might happen if they leave the U.S. But it sounds like there's some communities in southern Arizona that where the governments are also trying to get ready for policy changes that might be coming with the new administration. You wrote recently about the community of South Tucson, and it sounds like there's maybe a little bit of controversy about the step they took and the way in which they took it. Is that fair?
Yeah, so the case with South Tucson is that one of the council members, Brian Flagg, brought up a resolution to direct South Tucson Police Department to not comply with the orders of mass deportation. So South Tucson is a city within, it's a pueblo within a city. That's what it's called. And so they have their own city government. They have their own police department, fire department, and they're very small, 1.2 square miles cities with about 5,000 residents, which the mayor has said is... has vulnerable communities in it, like the undocumented community. So they really wanted to make a stance against Trump coming into office, and they wanted to make it a resolution, which, as opposed to what other people have done, other cities have done, like the city of Tucson, is make a statement. Having a resolution in place is subject to legal challenge, which is something that the city attorney said at the meeting. Additionally, in the resolution, it had said that police officers must phone in or they must call over on the radio why they're stopping people and, you know, the reasoning behind that. So the police officer, the police chief, was against having to add in extra steps to stops. And the city attorney said that the city of South Tucson could face legal repercussions, which would cost the city money in the end if there were lawsuits to come their way if they were to do a resolution. So instead of doing a resolution, they did, like many other cities, they are drafting a statement to direct the police to not comply with mass deportations. So that's what's happening in South Tucson, though it did not end up being a resolution. There was really strong support from the council, though there were more concerns about what that would mean for the city if they were to pass it as a resolution. So that's why in the end they decided to do a public statement, and it will be signed by the city council and the police chief as well.
Interesting. All right. That is Susan Barnett, deputy editor of Tucson Spotlight and Foco de Tucson. Susan, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Tom Myers has been called Mr. Grand Canyon. Not only is he an avid hiker and explorer in the canyon, he's also the authority on canyon wilderness medicine. For decades, he served as the doctor at Grand Canyon National Park. He still works there part-time today. In a new profile of him for Arizona Highways magazine, writer Annette McGivney tells his story from how he almost didn't become a doctor at all to his treatment of everything from gunshot wounds to heart attacks to deaths from heat stroke. Myers is also the co-author of what McGivney describes as the backcountry Bible for anyone venturing below the rim, the 2001 book Over the Edge, Death in Grand Canyon, which lists every known death in the park and tries to guide visitors away from meeting the same fate. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with them both recently about it all, and McGivney told her when she first moved to Flagstaff and wanted to hike in the Grand Canyon, there was always one name that came up, Tom Myers.
Then he came out with this book right around that time called Death in Grand Canyon, or Over the Edge. Everyone just calls it Death in Grand Canyon. But I just got to know Tom just through that community of hikers, and as he was a medical expert and a very humble doctor, but the person that had all the information about, you know, dangerous hazards for hikers and backpackers. And I think around that time in the 1990s, climate change was really starting to kick in. And there were these massive heat waves that were happening in Grand Canyon where people were dying from heat stroke in a way that maybe hadn't happened to such a degree before. And I really started paying attention to Tom and what he was saying about the dangers of heat in Grand Canyon. And as a journalist, I thought that was very important. I was Southwest editor for Backpacker Magazine at the time. Mm-hmm. And Tom just was on the leading edge. I just came to really respect him over the decades for the knowledge that he has had.
Yeah. And I want to talk about some of those issues you brought up in just a moment as well. But Tom, let's turn to you first and talk a little bit about your story and what led you here, which Annette tells so well in this piece for Arizona Highways. It sounds like there was a point at which you thought you weren't going to become a doctor at all, right? Like you were going to kind of quit nearing the end of medical school, nearing the end of your training.
Yeah, that was a really, really stressful time in my life. To go that far to get to my senior year and just feel disenchanted. And I thought I made the wrong decision. I was on the wrong path. It's kind of like hiking in Grand Canyon. You know, if you go down a certain route or trail and you keep hoping that the destination will be worth the pain of the journey. Mm-hmm. As I got to the end, I realized that I really wasn't happy. You know, I struggled with what to do. And yeah, I really seriously considered leaving. And fortunately, seems like it was fate, but you know, life had a different plan for me. Maybe yeah. It was just destiny or, you know, providence, but it sure worked out well to end up at Grand Canyon, changing my life.
Right. So you end up as the doctor at the Grand Canyon, training under someone who became sort of your mentor and doing both of these things, right? Like becoming someone who can live and be immersed in the canyon in a way that it sounds like you always wanted to be, but also becoming a doctor and doing medical treatment there. Did it feel like at the time, like this has to be the path I take? This was meant to be?
It did. Almost instantly. My attitude went 180 degrees to the other direction. I told my wife, even months within that job, I considered myself the happiest doctor on the planet. This is the greatest doctor job on earth.
But it wasn't like it was all easy, like Annette sort of was getting at there. Like this was not all adventure and fun. Like you were working in, this is the quote from Annette's piece, like treating patients in one of the most environmentally hazardous landscapes in the United States. What was it like?
Well, I think the hardest part for me was the call, for sure. Myself and my physician colleague, my partner, we were on call every other night for emergencies. So we'd see patients during the day, you know, for appointments and urgent care and emergencies. And then at night, we would flip-flop the call. And, you know, I was surprised by how many emergencies would come through the clinic and some of them, you know, life-threatening. That was really, really hard. But, you know, I just felt so energized about being a doctor there, and partly because I think the patients are also the best patients you could ask for. That definitely helped buffer some of the stress and, you know, really difficult times in the middle of the night, handling somebody with a heart attack, for example. It helped buoy that up.
Yeah. Annette, I want to turn to you because you mentioned this sort of at the beginning. There's this interesting thing that comes up in the piece, but that you both already, I think, have mentioned here, which is like the beauty, the love of the Grand Canyon that people like you clearly have, but also like this inherent danger in it. Like, do you think that is something you're able to reconcile in your work?
Yes, I feel like it's a respect that people in Flagstaff and at Grand Canyon that work for the national park, any dedicated hiker and backpacker, you know, that goes into the canyon regularly has a deep respect for the canyon and the dangers that it can have compared to like the tourist who's never been hiking in Grand Canyon and they go for the first time and they're kind of naive about it. And so there is this awareness and respect of the dangers that you're in the most beautiful place in the world, but it can also kill you. And Tom and I have friends who died, mm-hmm. you know, over the last couple of decades in the canyon through accidents, or, you know, they just made the wrong decision on river trips and backpacking trips. And, you know, I feel like Tom is more aware of that than anyone.
Yeah. Let me turn that to you, Tom, because this is probably the tension that you got asked about a lot. I'm guessing when your first book came out, the Over the Edge book about death in Grand Canyon, right? Like you're literally documenting every death that you can in the canyon, but at the same time, trying to guide people on how to do it right so that they can enjoy it. And Annette writes this in the piece that you seem to be, you know, OK to take a risk or two here and there when you're doing your own adventuring in the canyon, right?
Yes, I like to think my risks are, you know, calculated and based on experience. But I think that the thing that grabs people's attention is, you know, accidental death. And we all have a sort of morbid fascination with the topic. And if you can get somebody's attention by presenting, say, a tragic accident and then hold that attention, then slip in some life-saving lessons that were learned from the accident. You know, that there's an old saying within a EMS world that it's the same old accidents, just new faces. And it's true in Grand Canyon, you know, a lot of the mechanisms for dying are the same and they're new faces. They're people who often overestimate their ability and underestimate the wilderness, which is just, you know, a lethal combination.
Hmm. Let me back up just for a moment and ask you both what you love about it, right? Like, because you're talking about the hazards, the things that you've seen there, the difficulties, the challenges, the danger, right? But clearly, I mean, this is something you both really love. Annette, start there. Like, why did you move to Flagstaff, start becoming one of these hikers in the Grand Canyon?
I just love being in the canyon and feeling so small. It's just like hitting the reset button on my, you know, emotional state to be in this like spectacular place that's so wild and beautiful. And I'm just this little tiny dot in it. And the way it affects my perspective about life is sort of like it sustains me. So I, you know, if I'm away from the canyon for too long, then that perspective like starts to become, you know, a distant memory. So I feel like I better get back in there and hit the reset button again.
What about you, Tom? What do you love about Grand Canyon?
I just chose when I was young, I was like, well, I really want to know a landscape intimately, and this is it. I just made a decision that I wanted to know it and experience. And I think to quote John Denver, you know, really, it fills up my senses, you know, my sight, my vision, what I hear, what I feel, what I touch. I just love the physical challenge of getting in there and pushing myself and to see what I made of it emotionally, physically. I do know my limits, but you know, like Annette said too, I can't get enough. I just need to keep returning there. And I'm just so excited that I still have that opportunity and I have the health to go in there and explore it.
Yeah. All right, we'll leave it there. That is Dr. Tom Myers as well as Annette McGivney joining us. Thank you both so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
Yeah, thanks, Lauren. I appreciate you having us.
A new book sheds light on a difficult decision some parents in Mexico are facing, trading one form of violence for another. That choice centers on informal treatment centers known as anexos. They're purportedly for people suffering from addiction or mental health issues, but as my next guest explains, what goes on inside is controversial. Angela Garcia is an anthropologist and professor at Stanford. Her book is called The Way That Leads Among the Lost: Life, Death, and Hope in Mexico City's Anexos. She joins me to talk about what she found. And Angela, for folks who might not be familiar with Anexos, can you please start off by explaining what exactly they are?
Sure. They are lay treatment centers for addiction, mental illness. They're run by and for Mexico's working poor, which comprises over 50% of the population, and they're not regulated. They're run by people with no professional training, and they are known for their use of coercion and violence. And so they're very controversial in Mexico. At the same time, they're proliferating throughout the country.
What kinds of coercion and violence do we see in these?
Well, people are kidnapped. That is their entry into these spaces, which I should say tend to be one room filled with anywhere between 15 and 40 people. They're kidnapped in a pretty brutal way that mimics some of the tactics of criminal organizations. And they're thrown in, literally thrown into these spaces, and they stay there until their family can no longer pay because there is a monthly fee. Or they escape, or they're deemed in some way rehabilitated. In addition to the kidnapping as a way of entry, there's the use of both psychological and physical violence in these spaces, but they're deemed a form of treatment.
But as you say, the people who are running these and doing the treatment don't really have any training in how to do it. So like for the people who attend these anexos, do they actually get any kind of help for the issues they're dealing with?
Well, that was precisely what I was looking at. And the training that people get, those that run them, is essentially having been in them themselves. So a lot like in the US, where you have addiction treatment counselors, many of whom were, had addiction problems themselves,
Yeah.
it's similar in Mexico. And the kinds of things that I was looking at, I realized quickly that not everyone there had problems with drug addiction or mental illness. A lot of the people in there, and we're talking about a very young population, were at risk of the violence that surrounds the drug war. So over time, I began to understand that while there were and are people who have addiction problems and problems with mental health, a lot of the young people that are there are actually vulnerable to both criminal and neighborhood violence. And so their families, usually mothers, put them into these spaces as a way to keep them safe.
This is one of the more interesting aspects, I think, that you write about in terms of it's almost like picking a less problematic form of violence for these parents who are sending their kids to these, because, as you say, they're trying to escape cartel violence. But at the same time, the place where these kids are being sent, they will, in some cases, maybe more than some, be victims of violence themselves there.
Exactly. And the decision to put kids into these spaces weighs very heavily on parents, and particularly women. And, you know, they have to make a kind of ethical wager between what is worse, what is better. And they put their kids in knowing that, you know, they might come out 20 pounds thinner, they might come out bruised, they might come out, you know, depressed or angry. And yet, families often see these as their best option for keeping their kids or young adults safe from the pervasive violence across Mexico.
So is the calculation then basically at its, maybe at its basest, is yes, my child might come out bruised, mentally wounded, scarred, but they will come out. They'll be alive.
Exactly. And a lot of mothers that I talked to said, you know, I know things are going on inside, but I know where my kid is. I know they're being fed. I know there's, you know, are around people similarly situated. I know they're getting attention. But most importantly, I know where they are.
What do you think the proliferation of these anexos says about the state of society in Mexico, maybe the state of the amount of violence, cartel violence that is there right now?
Well, that was how I really began to understand them, as a lens upon the state of Mexico today. And they're proliferating precisely because violence is intensifying. And I really want to add that there are also anexos in the United States. And so Mexican immigrants are bringing this structure of treatment into the U.S., but the issues that are described in these anexos are very different. Here in the U.S., rather than talking about, you know, experiences of drug-related violence or criminal violence, people will talk about their concerns around immigration status, finding affordable housing, and yet they use the structure and method of anexos in Mexico in order to address problems that immigrant communities here are facing.
Well, I'm curious what you heard from some of the kids who were in anexos in Mexico about, specifically about the calculation that their parents made about, yes, this place might not be great, but it sure seems a lot better than not being there.
For the most part, the people that I talked to recognized that their families, their mothers, were trying to keep them safe. You know, they weren't happy about it. A lot of them described anger, resentment, feelings that, you know, when I get out, I'm never going to speak to my mother again. But they also recognized that, you know, their families had to work very hard to keep them in these places. And so there was a level of commitment to them that they acknowledged. And so some of them, you know, would say to me, you know, I hate that I'm here. I hate that my mother put me here, but I know that she did it because she loves me and she doesn't want to lose me. And that's precisely what mothers would say. They would say, you know, my kid is driving me nuts. I don't feel safe, but I don't want to lose my kid. So I'm going to put them here and I'm going to risk the kinds of risks that exist in a Nexos, but I see them as a safer option. And the kids that were in there recognized that their mothers had to make this difficult decision.
So what do you think the future of a Nexos looks like, both in Mexico and in the US?
I think so long as there are the kinds of intense social problems and economic problems that both countries are facing, especially for low-income people, and in this country for undocumented immigrants, they're just going to keep proliferating. And that really says a lot about the world that we live in, that people have to make this kind of decision in order to keep their loved ones safe.
All right. That is Angela Garcia, an anthropologist and professor at Stanford. Her latest book is called The Way That Leads Among the Lost: Life, Death, and Hope in Mexico City's Nexos. Angela, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. The Apple TV show Severance recently launched its second season after a three-year hiatus. The show's Sam Dingman has been eagerly anticipating its return.
If you, like me, are a fan of the show Severance, maybe you've had this experience where you try to recommend the show to somebody and you realize you're not quite sure how to describe it. There's the basic premise. Four people work at a company called Lumen Industries, and none of them know what the company does. But it's more complicated than that. The reason they don't know is that they've all had this medical procedure called severance that divides their brain into two distinct identities, an innie, which is the version of themselves that only exists at the office, and an outie, the version that exists in the outside world. Their identities switch every time they get on the elevator at Lumen Industries. But the part of Severance that's hard to express is that even though it's set in a sterile corporate environment, it somehow feels like you're watching a horror movie. There's this vibrating sense of tension and foreboding that pervades the series as the mystery of what Lumen really does and whether Severance is reversible gradually unfolds. It's incredibly unnerving to watch and totally intoxicating. For our pop culture expert, Amanda Kerberg, part of the show's seductive power has to do with its production design.
The aesthetics are so comforting to me. Makes me so happy. There's just ritual and simplicity and kind of like light jazz music, like you're always in an elevator.
Yeah. Let's talk about the aesthetics, though, a little bit more, because it's one of those things that the show has thought about at such a deep level.
It almost feels like being in like a 90s Microsoft screensaver in some ways. Like there are so many just blank white hallways. Everything is bright, bright, bright. And then you look around and just the way that they have these like romantic era paintings of the internal work history. They're what do you call that? The internal comms are all look like mid-century Soviet like propaganda posters.
Right.
Like
so much of the show, to my mind, is making fun of this idea of corporate culture. And it really foregrounds it in this way of having like these oil paintings with, you know, stark, emotionless Soviet design. Like these things make so little sense next to each other, much like the words corporate and culture.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
One of the things I was reminded of that I had sort of forgotten about aesthetically in watching the first episode of season two is the work that the main characters of the show are doing in their department, which is called macro data refinement, which is another sort of wonderfully meaningless phrase.
Yes.
Is they just have this grid of numbers.
Yeah.
And they kind of scroll a mouse over the numbers and eventually they click and some of the numbers go tumbling into this animated bucket. And then a little chime sounds that indicates that they did it right. It's absurdly meaningless.
Oh, yes. It's wonderful.
But to me, what the show does in such an interesting way is explore that space that you were alluding to earlier, that there are some people who actually kind of crave that, who crave that opportunity to kind of tune out for a little while. But then you start to wonder what you're a part of.
I mean, that sort of sense of escapism certainly is something we all crave in media. The way that we watch things, we're never fully sutured into them anymore. Like, particularly in an era of information overload, and I think it plays with those themes as well, we do crave that kind of escapism, suturing into another story world, which is sort of what he does every day, you know, our POV character, Mark, by choosing to escape his sad, you know, real life.
This suturing idea is fascinating to me. I hadn't heard that term before, and I love it. And I agree with you. That is something that I crave more than ever now, is a TV experience, a movie experience that makes me feel completely, like, entombed with this work for as long as it's going to last. But perhaps the brilliance of Severance is that it does that to you. And then the subject matter is, do you really want to be entombed?
Yes, exactly, exactly.
It's kind of forcing you to look at what you crave.
Yeah.
This also makes me think about another very deep human thing that I think the show is playing on that I hadn't thought about until you said this, is there is always this question at work of how much of myself do I bring to the job?
Yeah.
It is so strange that we go to work and we play this character version of ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that is oddly alluring about the Severance idea is, what if you just went and were turned into a person you don't even know about, so you're not responsible for how they behave?
Yeah. No, it's such a great sort of realization of Foucault and power, too, which I, like, anytime I talk about Foucault, I love to talk about the episode of SpongeBob where he becomes normal.
Speaking of words that I don't often hear in proximity to each other, Foucault and SpongeBob.
So, like, right, Foucault talks about, like, the power of the state and how it exerts itself on the human body. And so it's this big treatise on sort of industrialization and the way that time inserts itself into our lives and what it does to our physical selves and our mental selves. And there's this episode of SpongeBob where he like, throughout the episode, gets physically smoothed into this smooth sponge. And he goes to tell Squidward, like, look, I'm normal now. And he, instead of going into his, like, normal fry cook space, he goes into a cubicle every day. And he's constantly watching the clock. Huh. And it's just this perfect, like, this is the exertion of state power onto the body. The physicality has been smoothed out. Difference has been smoothed out.
So I will say, one of the feelings that came up for me that felt different in 2025 than it did in 2021 and 2022 when I was watching the original season was, for me, the relationship with work element of the show has morphed into a conversation about the relationship with escapism. One of the reasons that Severance stood out is because it was asking us to think at a time when television during the pandemic for so many people was a way of not thinking.
Oh, that's so true. And yes, so it was all comfort nostalgia. Yeah.
Now we have this thing that for many people on the left, they don't want to think about, a system that feels oppressive. And here is this show that is saying, I think you should be thinking about it.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And I think there's a little bit of a shift in the feel of it, you know, already in season two, because it takes on, I think, even more of an existentialist tone, because we have these people who've been, you know, fighting to get answers to their questions, but the ultimate answer to their question is essentially their own death. If they're no longer working there, then their severed selves cease to exist. So there is a kind of existentialist embrace of just pushing the rock up the hill again and again and again, and embracing the moment when you get to look down and see the rock roll back down again and finding joy in that.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it is too much of a spoiler to say that a lot of the action in the first episode of season two is centered on the question of whether or not the four primary characters will continue to work at Lumen Industries, which means, to your point, will they keep these severed versions of themselves alive? And I think that, again, points at what is so oddly appealing and unnerving about the show is that it is a show about this odd performative version of yourself. And then now it seems like it's becoming a show about why you maybe kind of need that version of yourself, because it helps give you some perspective on the rest of yourself.
Yes, yes. And questioning like how false that version is ultimately. If you do the performance so often, at what point is it not performance?
Well, Amanda Kerberg is a PhD student at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and our resident pop culture expert. Amanda, thank you as always.
Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.